SimCar 33, Horace, we have a guest. Why don't you introduce Sam?
Sam is joining us from Detroit, I believe. Sam Abuel-Samid. He is a research analyst, a senior research analyst with Navigant. I think focused on energy, but you must be somehow looking at the car business. Is that right?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I'm a senior analyst with Navigant Research, and Navigant Research as a whole is focused on clean energy technologies. And I'm part of the transportation team. So we focus on areas that affect transportation efficiency. So we look at things like advanced transportation technologies like autonomous systems, ADAS, alternative fuels, connected vehicles, automotive cybersecurity is an area we're into now. So all the interesting stuff that's going on in the transportation space.
So you come to us because you sent emails in the past saying that you were a listener and you gave us a lot of info privately, observations, and we thought, why not have you join us for a on-the-air conversation? And you seem to have a wealth of knowledge on production systems as well as all the materials impact, energy, all of these factors related to car production. So in particular, you, I think we want to start a little bit to go deeper into the carbon process at BMW, if that's something you can enlighten us on. Please do.
Sure. For a little bit more background on me, I've been in the automotive industry about 30 years now, including the time I worked as a co-op when I was studying mechanical engineering at what's now Kettering University. And so I've worked as an engineer, as a journalist, communications, and now as a technology analyst. So I've been following all of the technologies, whether it's things I've been working with directly or just out of interest as somebody who's fascinated with technology for my entire adult life. And I think on the Critical Path, one or two episodes ago, you guys were talking about BMW. I think it was part of your discussion of the i3. And I shared a few thoughts with you about what BMW is doing there. As you surely know, the first road car to use carbon fiber for its structure, back in the early 90s, was the McLaren F1.
Sure, Gordon Murray's. Yep.
Yeah. So, it's been used in a few other supercars, over the years since then. But the i3 is the first car, approaching sort of a mainstream price point that's ever used a full carbon fiber structure like that. And, the whole i3 and i8 project at BMW has been a fascinating one to watch over the last 8 or 9 years as it's evolved. Started back in, I think, about 2007. 2007, they kicked it off, what they called Project I at the time, before they and made the decision to use the I branding for these advanced electric vehicles. And the idea at the time was that they wanted to take a look at as the world is getting more and more urbanized, and we've got these mega cities that are growing. In 2015, for the first time in history, more than half of the world's population lived in urban areas. By 2030, they are projecting about two-thirds of the population, that's expected to be about 9 billion at that point, is going to live in cities. And so BMW, wanted to take a look at, what do they have to do to evolve their business and their products in order to be relevant in that kind of world. And that's where Project I came in.
In fact, the concept vehicle was called the Mega City Car, which didn't click with me until just now when I always thought it was Mega City Car. It's actually a mega city is the idea of the mega city as a car for the mega city, not the sort of big city car.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, BMW had experimented with electric vehicles in the past. But when they got into this project, you know, their first real world implementation of it was the Mini E concepts, the fleet, yep, of electric minis that they had built and released starting in late 2008. You know, and then that evolved. They used that as a way of learning about how people would actually use modern electric vehicles, you know, by putting that fleet of 500 electric minis into the hands of regular consumers for a couple of years. And then they followed that on with the Active E concept, you know, which advanced the technology, you know, going from, you know, the Mini E. They worked with AC Propulsion, the same guys, the same crew that got Tesla started, with the idea of using the commodity lithium ion cells, you know, in a pack with thousands of cells, driving an electric motor, you know, and they built the powertrains for those Mini E's, and then by the time BMW got to the Active E, they brought the powertrain development in house. I think A123 actually built the batteries for those vehicles, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And then subsequently for the production cars, they've gone to Samsung for the i3 and the i8. So, you know, it's been an interesting evolution to watch.
And one thing to note is that these experiments they ran with the Minis were in Europe. If I'm correct, is that true?
Yeah, there was a mix. They had several fleets. They had a fleet in Southern California, so they had a couple of hundred of the cars in Southern California. They had a couple of hundred cars in the U.S. Northeast, in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, and then they had about 100 of them in Europe as well.
Okay, so not Europe exclusively, but they were pretty much trying to figure out these markets that were most likely early adopter markets for EVs.
Exactly.
And yeah, so Los Angeles and so on. So yeah, please. So that's how they got started. They were looking at components and suppliers, and they were getting miles driven that would give them ideas about, for example, range, and for example, what is the typical distances people do, and where are the what is the sweet spot in terms of mix of capacity and range and size and so on.
Exactly. And so while they were collecting all this data, they were also developing these first two production models at the same time. And, you know, one of the things they came to realize was that, you know, because of the weight of batteries, you know, relative to liquid fuels, they realized that they needed to try and make the whole car as light as they possibly could to compensate for all the extra mass of the batteries. Mm-hmm. And so they turned to carbon fiber. You know, but obviously, you know, up to that point, that was an extremely expensive proposition. I mean, you know, it was primarily used in cars costing $500,000 or more. You know, I think the Porsche Carrera GT was probably about the most affordable carbon fiber structured car up to that point. I think that one was around $500,000. So, you know, they turned to this company in Washington, SGL, that, you know, has been doing carbon fiber for a long time. And, you know, one of the during the course of their study, one of the things they realized was that the carbon fiber that everybody had been using up to that point was aerospace grade fibers. You know, so they were very long strand fibers, producing very large components with the carbon fiber, you know, basically laying out, you know, almost the entire structure, and then impregnating it with the resin, the polymer resins, and baking that in an autoclave, doing virtually the entire structure as one large piece, much the way they typically do for race cars, for F1 race cars and other high-end race cars. And then, you know, what they had done prior to that for aerospace applications. And when they looked at what the requirements were for an automotive application in order to, you know, meet the safety requirements and reliability and durability, they realized that basically those structures were way over designed for what was needed. for an automotive application. And so they went back to square one, and they worked with SGL to develop processes, you know, to use shorter carbon fiber strands, lower grade but still extremely strong and lightweight. So they got the properties that they needed for a car structure at a much lower cost, and also producing smaller components and then bonding those together, so that they could be cured in smaller autoclaves, and also so that there was some mechanism for repairability in the field during the course of the vehicle's lifetime. They did all these things to bring the cost down, and it's still not clear, if they're actually, even break even. They're probably not, they're probably still losing money on the i3, but they've brought the cost down, by orders of magnitude from where it would be to produce a car like a McLaren F1 or a P1 or a LaFerrari, so they can now offer it in a car that starts in the mid $40,000 price range.
So did you see the teardown discussion by Monroe?
So
he mentions the fact that they were using scraps, or what was the correct term for the leftover bits, to make the roof out of carbon fiber, and he thought that was amazing. So they're able to actually and I suppose the roof is not as structurally important as the pillars are, but nevertheless, they're able to do this, and he called it a grade A surface or something like that. There was really an amazingly smooth surface from pieces. So a lot of what went into the production of the i3 involved not just the materials itself, but also processes and being able to reuse material that was normally not usable and left over. And that, and there's also, for those, I think we mentioned this already, but there's a set of videos on YouTube where you can watch the production system I think it's an hour long set of four videos that visually record the process. And it's really something from someone. I've seen dozens of films showing automobile production. From olden days to very modern, and there's a series on TV called either Mega Factories or something to that effect, where they've taken crews in and filmed the production of various cars, and so for everything from Porsche to Mini to the Mustang and others and the Tesla even. So that we've seen this, and when you look at production footage, the stuff that was done with the i3 is completely different than anything else. That's my impression. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. They took learnings from the way previous plastic composite vehicles, vehicles made with, for example, fiberglass bodies were done, and took some of the elements of what's been done previously with carbon fiber composites, and also developed some new things. And you mentioned grade A surfaces, and in the auto industry, when they talk about the various pieces of the car, they've got, I think, typically three different grades, where the visible, essentially the grade A surfaces are the visible surfaces that people will see, and those need to have the highest degree of finish and smoothness. Those are the surfaces that will be painted and are always visible to the consumer. Whereas the lower grade surfaces are the ones that are hidden away, that are not they're not visible. They have to be structurally sound, and they have to have certain properties, but they don't necessarily need to have the same degree of surface finish. Finishing carbon fiber composite panels, they also had to develop some processes for that as well, in order to
Because carbon fiber has a weave. It's a textured surface. It's not smooth into the touch or to the eye. And in fact, on you wouldn't, looking at an i3, you wouldn't be able to tell that there was carbon in the process. In fact, the body panels are mostly plastic. So if you were to hit the bumper area, the hood even, which is tiny, it sounds plastic, and it looks when you open it and look inside, you know, it is plastic. But the where carbon comes in is there's the frame. First of all, one thing we should point out is that the car is not that's called a unibody. It's actually a skateboard design where there are essentially a big girders, the big is aluminum beams that are, you know, more or less in an H or a ladder frame, onto which are bolted the battery, the drivetrain, and the suspension systems, and then eventually the exo or the skeleton. I don't know if it's exo or not, but it's the skeleton of the frame into which the passenger space is allocated. And that is meant to also protect the passenger. And I think they have a name for it. I forget now. But the that frame into which you sit is what's made of carbon fiber. And there's an A pillar and there's a C pillar. There isn't a B pillar. There's no place where the doors would anchor, for example. The doors actually anchor to one another. The rear doors act as the locking edge for the front door. So when you open all the doors, you have an open space. You can see right through the car from side to side. And what's interesting is that's where carbon plays a role here, because it's very rigid and yet only needs essentially two circular beams, with, of course, the roof holding it together and the floor pan holding it together. And so the design is very different than most cars, which come from sheet metal stampings, which are welded together. And because of the way they're welded and there are hundreds of parts usually that are welded, that creates the torsional rigidity and the crush impact zone and everything else. And that's a unibody or monocoque design. And this car goes back to pre the era of body on frame, and so for that's the interesting thing, is that it is body on frame, but the body is not really a body; it's this skeleton on frame onto which the skeleton is bolted the body panels, which actually are non-structural, but they absorb some. They have some crash impact properties. So that's how I see it. But in order for you to find the carbon, you have to open the doors and look down at the base or the sides of this frame and see slight bits which are unpainted, which clearly are carbon. In many cars where carbon is used, they actually want to showcase that. The Ferrari F40, for example, that's another supercar, I think, that had some carbon in it. And you know, the most car makers wanted to showcase that, and it would leave it unpainted. But not in this case. It's mostly hidden, I would say.
Yeah, it is mostly hidden, more so on the i3 than on the i8. On the i8, I actually just had one that I was driving for a week that just went back on 2 days ago. It's more visible on that car, but it's also a more expensive car, and it's more of a performance car than the i3. But it uses a very similar approach, structural approach, to the i3, just in a different architecture. You know, it's more low slung. You know, it's a sports car, and it's a plug-in hybrid. Whereas the i3, aside from the range extender, is a pure battery electric vehicle, and it does, as you say, you know, it's a body on frame. And one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, even carbon fiber, you know, technically is, you know, it's a composite. It's actually plastic, just like a Corvette, you know, or other cars made from fiberglass. You know, they all use plastic resins as the material that holds it all together. And it's just it's a matter of using different materials, different types of fibers to reinforce it and give it structural integrity. So in the case of Corvette, modern Corvettes are made of a variety of different composites, SMCs, but primarily using glass fibers as the reinforcing agent, whereas carbon fiber composites use a weave, essentially a fabric made of carbon fibers that have been woven together. And you know, what BMW has done differently for the iCars is using smaller sheets of this fabric, this carbon fabric, than what it has traditionally been used in the past for these sorts of applications. And so in various areas of the structure, they'll use pieces that have been, you know, essentially trimmings from other operations. You know, so using some of the scrap that was trimmed off for other pieces that are being made and putting that together, laying that into a mold and impregnating it with the resin and then curing it. And then joining all of these pieces together. So it's an interesting approach that has, as you said, driven down the cost of the system.
And the reason we talk about this, it sounds really arcane and boring, frankly, to a lot of lay people. But I think the reason this is interesting is because when we look at innovation in a lot of the products we touch, and I think the Apple story is interesting here, where Apple is didn't just create user experiences, but they wanted to create new enclosures for these experiences, which actually had a feel to them and the distinguishing characteristics. So this is why Macs are made of aluminum and phones are made of aluminum or of various new kinds of materials that there might be considering, like injection molded metals, like liquid metal, and new types of glass, or in the case of the watch, sapphire as a screen technology, and they're clever in using materials, and they're clever in using magnets, for example, and so the interesting thing is how they have taken materials into creating differentiated computing products, differentiated devices, and often at great expense in tooling, great expense in materials. But in the auto industry, it's not only about creating the material. The choice is fundamental to the ability to deliver the volume, cost, and performance desired. So, for example, everyone's trying to switch away from steel because it's heavy, and they're moving towards aluminum mainly now. But the dream a lot of designers have is to move towards composites, because composites are lighter and composites are stronger. And obviously, you know, as you pointed out, the supercars are determining the future in that respect. But so I guess the question is this significant? Because the attempt to go with carbon may have in some ways overshot the customer can absorb. They've lowered the price by an order of magnitude, but is it enough? Because does it scale? Does it allow the designer to create a truly differentiated product? And as I pointed out, yes, you got rid of the B pillar on the i3, but it isn't stunningly beautiful in that sense. They haven't been able to really redefine. It's kind of got I wouldn't say ugly, but it's got a completely new look.
Utilitarian.
let me just defend the ugly point for a minute, because a lot of people, first thing they say about it is it's ugly. Well, if you were to gaze upon a Volkswagen Beetle in 1950 compared to what was in the marketplace at the time with these American cars, which were all about elegance and chrome and size. And even the European cars, British cars at the time. And when the British auto industry looked at the VW Beetle, they said, this thing is ugly, this thing is useless, this thing is wrong, this is a crap design with the engine in the rear. And then same thing was said by the Ford company, and nobody wanted to touch the VW Asset. It became iconic, and in fact, the ugly cars are the ones that end up being iconic. There was nothing really beautiful about a Mini. There was nothing beautiful about a 2CV, or I would say this is maybe an exception, is the Fiat 500. I think is beautiful, but maybe I don't know. It's hard to put it in context of what it was like back then. These cars were designed for. As an engineer might think about a problem, and the problem may have been how can we make millions of these, or the problem may have been how we make this as the Mini was built around the concept of packaging and squeezing as much as you can inside of a small package in terms of ability to carry people. And that was the same thing with the Fiat 500. It was designed around the idea of carrying five people and has the highest ratio of interior space to exterior dimensions. So these types of design-led thinking wasn't, let's make the car beautiful and worry about capacity, because a Corvette is beautiful, but it's impractical. And so the beauty came from within. The beauty that was recognized in the VW, in all of these iconic people's cars, is that they mobilized people. They were extremely effective at the design job they were hired to do, and that's what shone through and became classic and became beautiful in the long term. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen to the i3, but you have to look beyond that and think in the longer picture about what beauty means in the car industry. I don't think it's just first impressions. So I think you can start to reflect on what the design of the car is all about, and I think that the design of the i3 is, let's unleash these engineers onto a problem of making as an efficient car as possible, given the constraints we have today, which are generally driving weight way off the scale. And these guys ended up with a car that's extremely lightweight compared to its equivalent brothers and sisters who are making, you know, who are electric driven cars. And the other thing is that, you know, it has 124 miles per gallon equivalent, right? So it's that figure is way bigger than a Tesla. Tesla is around 88. So it's 50% more efficient than a Tesla. And so on that basis, it's actually way more efficient than any other car in the United States and possibly in Europe as well. So I have to say that to me is beautiful.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, from an engineering perspective, you know, efficiency in any number of ways, whether it's energy efficiency or the resources it takes to build it. You know, I mean, efficiency is always the goal of an engineer, is to do something as efficiently as possible, to use the least possible resources to get the job done. And, you know, what you see in the i3 and the i8, you know, they use a lot of, those two cars use a lot of the same technologies, but the two cars couldn't be more different. You know, and the i3 really reflects the original concept behind, you know, that megacity project. You know, if when you look at it, you see it's got a comparatively small footprint in terms of how much space it takes up on the road. You know, and that goes back to that idea of how do you efficiently move people around in these megacities. You know, and one part of
it's funny, just thanks for that, but it's just, there's an interesting design element that I hadn't thought of right now. It has very tight turning radius. It's huge wheels, but they're very narrow. So it's kind of odd looking in from the wheels point of view. See, the other thing is that it doesn't have a little front end. The front end is almost there only for safety reasons. The little front area, there's nothing. You open it up and there's almost nothing to put as storage. It's an odd thing to put there. As a result, the whole car and the engine lives between the rear wheels. It's almost as if it's kind of like hidden in spare in a spare corner of the car, because of course an electric motor is no bigger than a big watermelon. So it can go right in between the wheels, and they reserve this the next to it the spot on the other side for
for the generator. And the generator, which is the range extender, is this little two-cylinder scooter engine. It literally is an engine from a not a motorcycle but a scooter, and it's 650 cc's. It is incidentally the same as a late Fiat 500 from the 1970s, which actually was the Fiat 600 by then, but it was essentially a 600 cc engine, and or 650. And it's remarkable that that fits in the little niches as well, and that can drive the whole car. Although its performance is severely restricted, but you can make it on the highway and keep driving on essentially 33 horsepower. So 33 horsepower motor that acts as a generator, and of course has losses in the process to drive the electric motor through you know this indirect way. And your air conditioning and whatever else, and this car can sustain highway speeds on a scooter engine. I think that's remarkable. And in the form of the packaging that it achieves on that, and you have a full rear hatch which you can then load up stuff into. I don't want to get all gushing about the i3. The point is, I think that the types of innovations that they're driving at here are across the board in terms of carbon fiber, in terms of the electric, and the design itself of the vehicle is extraordinary. Having said all that, it hasn't done all that well, has it? I mean, as far as a going product. Yeah, the process. Okay. Maybe he's jumping too far ahead. Can you tell us about the i8 a little bit? Just how does that compare? You've said you've driven one.
Yeah, I just spent a week with an i8, and you know where the i3 is purely electric drive, you know, and you have the option for the range extender for you know when the battery is depleted, that can give you about another 90 miles of range. The i8 is a plug-in hybrid, so it has an electric motor at the front axle, and then at the rear axle, it has a three-cylinder, 1.5-liter turbocharged engine, gasoline engine, driving the rear wheels. And you can switch it. You can switch modes. You can drive it in electric-only mode around town. Get about 17 miles of range. It has it's a smaller battery. It's only 7.1 kilowatt hours, and the battery sits down the center tunnel instead of in a skateboard form, as it does in the i3, and then you've got the engine driving the gasoline engine driving the rear wheels, and combined, they produce about roughly 360 horsepower. And with the car's low weight, it'll accelerate from 0 to 60 in about 4.2 seconds. So it's very quick. You know, very low center of gravity, low slung, and you know the thing looks like a spaceship. You know, I took it to a Cars and Coffee event here in Detroit over the weekend and pulled up behind a Lamborghini Gallardo, and all of a sudden everyone was ignoring the Lamborghini and flying all over the BMW.
Well, it's a pretty rare car still. I mean, there aren't many around. Yeah.
No, they're quite rare.
Yeah. It does look amazing. And I saw one once on the highway in California, and I couldn't. It was really strange looking to me. But I'll say this much also. I saw a YouTube video of a guy who actually had a Ferrari G-Wagen and this i8, and he said the i8 by far gets the most attraction, attracts the most attention, and it was, he said, do not get this car if you want to be if you want to be inconspicuous. Right. But this car is a bit of an odd car, though. You said it's essentially a two-engine vehicle. It's a hybrid, but it's kind of not the Prius type of hybrid, and has a 1.5 three-cylinder engine, which is not supercar, but in combination with an electric power for the front, it combines to be something a little bit above a Porsche 911, so it's plenty fast.
Oh yeah, and you know, it's what's known as a through the road hybrid. So rather than having the electric drive and the engine sharing sharing duties at one axle and doing a power split the way most hybrids, including the Toyotas, do it, that you actually have two independent powertrains at one at each axle, and the connection comes through the road, hence the name through the road hybrid. So it's a little bit of a different duck, and there are a few other similar vehicles on the road. Peugeot, Citroën, their hybrid 4 system that they have on a couple of different models in Europe is also a through the road hybrid, but reverse. They have a diesel engine at the front axle, driving the front wheels, and then electric motor for all wheel drive at the rear axle. So it's the reverse of this one.
So let's step back a bit. This has been an interesting experiment. The iSeries, years in the making, concepting based on observations about megacities, observations about sustainability, trying to be green in not just in having electric drive or hybrid, but also in terms of production methods, in terms of energy used in production, in terms of, and this I heard as well, is that the servers that were used in testing the car in crash testing, right, the simulation of crash tests, those servers were located in Iceland because that was where they could get hydroelectric
renewables, right.
Right. And that's power. That's one of the reasons why SGL is located in Washington State.
Yeah, hydropower.
They use entirely hydroelectric power out there as well.
It's a very German thing to do, isn't it? Sort of trying to look at the car and trying to be green about it in every way.
The whole philosophy, the ideology, right. So what have we learned from this?
But the problem is, economically, has it worked? And it doesn't look like they're following up on those two models with a classic portfolio expansion or building
I think they will over the next several years. At their recent annual meeting, their CEO talked about a significant expansion of their electrified portfolio over the next 4 to 5 years.
But not under the I brand, is it? That's the problem.
Well, we will see additional models under the I brand as well. The problem, as far as sales, the commercial success or lack thereof of the i3 and the i8 is not something that's unique to BMW. I mean, this is something that is common pretty much across the industry. Really, the only brand that has had any significant success with electrification, is Tesla.
Even though they're losing money on every car, though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of sales,
one half i3 on every car.
Demand.
Yeah.
Right. To a lesser extent, Nissan and to some degree General Motors with the Volt, they've had some success, but it's not, neither of those vehicles has been as successful as had been hoped. That said, the manufacturers are pressing ahead. GM is launching the Chevrolet Bolt EV this fall, which will be the first affordable 200-mile range electric vehicle. And then Nissan is upgrading the Leaf this year with a larger battery to get it to 100-mile range. The next generation Leaf will probably arrive in about 2018. More than likely with a 200-mile range as well, in order to be competitive with the Bolt and the Model 3.
And by the way, the i3 also is getting upgraded with more battery,
right?
The i3
is getting an upgrade this fall. In general, there hasn't been a lot of consumer demand for electrification, and at least part of that is due to the limited capability of the vehicles that have been available so far, particularly at the affordable price points. That's changing slowly. That will improve. And then of course the other factor has been the low fuel prices. The collapse in the price of oil since the latter part of 2014 has also hurt. So you've got all these things happening, but at the same time, manufacturers aren't giving up on electrification. Partly because they know that over the long haul, they need to go this direction, and also in order, you know, they've got various regulatory mandates in California and in Europe and other places. So they know that they have to develop these vehicles, get them into the marketplace, get consumers accustomed to them. And at the same time, you know, they're bringing out subsequent generations of vehicles. You know, as the battery technology improves and gets more affordable, the range will get better. You know, various construction techniques. You know, yeah, the i3, you know, has not been a sales barn burner, but some of the technologies from that car are already finding their way into other BMW models.
Yeah.
Through their plug-in hybrids, and also the new 7 Series, the current generation 7 Series, has incorporated some of the carbon fiber techniques as part of the structure that came from the i3 and the i8.
That's how the management is spinning it exactly, is that they're learning from this, from a lot of the production. It's kind of like almost their R&D lab for new production techniques, new powertrains, and they're graduating those techniques from the labs into their mainstream production, which again, I in some ways I kind of buy it. It is probably the right thing to do, because we heard from Monroe that this doesn't scale beyond 150K units. And by the way, we're also informed by Gordon Murray and his discussion on the iStream. And are you familiar with with that? Yeah. So the iStream story is also 50 to 200,000, and that's not even the carbon, although they do have a carbon carbon process they're proposing as well. But this was using far less less exotic system of sort of mild steel tubular frame plus composites and adhesives, and the composites would be more plastic or other material. And so the iStream process, it doesn't scale beyond 200,000, and so in order for these novel production systems to be deployed onto mainstream platforms, something has to change. Something has to be different. I think the critical question for steel or even aluminum is that they are still the kings when it comes to large scale, which is maybe why Tesla went that way, not with anything exotic. I don't know. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what we're increasingly seeing, and we'll see even more of going forward, is that there's no silver bullet. There's not one perfect material for building vehicles, because you know, in engineering, there's this concept of there's budgets for everything in a big engineering project, and it's not just a matter of dollars and cents, but you have weight budgets, you have power budgets, you know, in developing a vehicle, you know, you have a target weight that you need to get to within a certain cost constraint, and so you look at all, you know, every aspect of a vehicle structure and figure out what is the best material to use in this part of the vehicle to get the properties that I need and also fit within this larger budget of, you know, performance budgets and cost budgets. And so what we're going to see more and more of is a multi-material mix in structures. So rather, you know, we'll see, you know, some lower volume vehicles, you know, use predominantly, you know, carbon fiber intensive structures like the i3, but we'll also see mixed structures like the 7 Series. The new Cadillac CT6 uses a mix of aluminum, steel, carbon fiber, magnesium in various places, because each of these materials has different properties. And so, you know, for example, you know, magnesium doesn't stamp well, but it's good for castings. You know, so they're using magnesium for things like the IP beam, the crosscar beam behind the instrument panel. You know, other places using steel for the rails, you know, that form part of the crush structure, the crush zone in the front and the rear of the car. You know, and as a great example, on the latest Honda Civic that went on sale late last year, Honda did some very interesting things with that, using different steel alloys, but in the frame rails that form the crush zones in the front and rear of the vehicle.
Hey, Mark.
These are steel tubes, that hydroform tubes. But what they did was in dyes that they used to form these tubes, they actually incorporated cooling zones within the dyes that are are on different parts of this beam. So as they form this beam, they've basically applied localized heat treatments to the steel in different parts of the beam, so that when there's an impact, it will crush in those zones in a controlled way. So they could keep the overall structure lighter and get the strength where they need it in specific zones. So there's all kinds of interesting innovations going on in terms of the materials and the manufacturing. A couple of years ago, Ford showed a concept based on the Fusion sedan, the midsize sedan, which is sold as the Mondeo in Europe and other parts of the world.
Sure.
They called it the multi-material lightweight vehicle concept. Okay. And they actually reduced the weight, went and dropped 33% of the Tuesday's weight from a standard production Fusion on this car, while without sacrificing any performance dramatically improving the fuel efficiency, by using a variety of different materials. They've got aluminum in some places, magnesium, some carbon fiber. It has carbon fiber wheels, carbon fiber in a couple of different parts of the structure. The windshield is made of Gorilla Glass. It's a Gorilla Glass composite that Corning developed, and so they use that on the concept, and actually the first production application of that is on the Ford GT that's launching this year. But we'll see things like that coming to cars. They cut the weight of the windshield on the GT by 12 pounds by using this Gorilla Glass sandwich instead of the traditional glass laminate that is used for windshields. So there's a lot of interesting innovations going on. So we're going to see pieces of this coming together in a lot of different ways.
So let's ask the big questions now about, your view on, besides BMW I, but what about, what do you think of Tesla's ambition now that we see them angling for, half a million units? Do you think that there's any chance they're going to deliver on that?
In 2018?
Yeah.
I would be shocked if they do. I mean, I hope Tesla succeeds, but I would be extremely shocked if they can manage to produce 500,000 cars in 2018. To ramp up that quickly, there's only a certain number of companies that manufacture the kind of tooling needed to do this sort of manufacturing, and the lead times to produce this tooling and get it installed. It takes quite some time, and it's not even clear if there's enough floor space within the Fremont factory that they have right now, the Fremont, California factory, to produce, to have that kind of production capacity.
Yeah.
So they'll probably have to expand that or add another facility somewhere. It just doesn't seem realistic. The timing doesn't seem realistic.
So a lot of people who have been asked this question seem to respond the same way, and maybe we're just not believers in the mystique and magic of Elon Musk. But do you think that? So the question for Tesla is: I mean, you said that they're unique in that they were able to harness a lot of demand, but is the Tesla story one of innovation beyond the powertrain and maybe the supercharger network and maybe the dealership or lack thereof? Do you see something in the way the product is made, or is it, because if I were to evaluate like on an efficiency basis, their approach has been one of no compromise in terms of performance, but that's not what you end up with is a heavy vehicle. And generally that means less efficiency. And so they're simply saying that the priority should not be on pure green credentials. It should be on making a desirable product. And is that the correct approach in your opinion? Is that what's going to succeed in the market? Is solving the problem as consumers see performance?
I think, you know, in the near to midterm, I think that actually probably is the right approach, because, you know, as we've seen, you know, with other plug-in vehicles, right now they're still in most markets. I mean, there's a few exceptions, you know, places like Norway and to some degree the Netherlands, but in most markets around the world, there just isn't consumer demand for electrification. And so in order for an electric vehicle to succeed, it needs to have appeal on its own merits, you know, apart from the green factor. You know, I mean, with Tesla, with the Roadster and the Model S, you know, there were some number of buyers that, you know, bought it because it was electric. But, you know, I think a lot of the buyers that bought into it, you know, because they saw that the brand was trying to, you know, part of it was the brand that they've built up, but, you know, they were getting something that was, you know, really impressive on its own merits, regardless of what type of powertrain it is. You had this big, beautiful car that could go ridiculously fast, and to consumers that are spending upwards of $100,000 for the car, you know, those were the kinds of characteristics that they wanted in a car, and the fact that it happened to be electric was, if anything, for most consumers, more of a bonus than anything else. And I think, you know, that's what I think everybody is starting to realize to some degree right now. You know, a lot of the cars that we're seeing coming to market from other brands over the next year or two, you know, some are already here. The big European brands, they're doing battery electric cars, but they're also doing a lot of plug-in hybrids. And what they've been doing is taking a slightly different tack from, you know, what Toyota has traditionally done, where their focus has been on efficiency. You know, and they realize that there's a limited market right now, at least for that. So they've been focusing on developing hybrids and plug-in hybrids that are tuned more for performance. You know, and they can sell the performance aspect of it at a premium. So they're giving hybrid electric vehicles that have better performance than the equivalent car with a gas or a diesel engine. They can, and then they can capture the price premium that offsets the additional cost of that powertrain. You know, in Tesla's case, you know, they've also got this unique factor, you know, of that brand, you know, that almost Apple-like halo around the brand. You know, whether Tesla can succeed, you know, whether they can get enough people to pay high enough prices for their cars to actually be profitable, sustainably profitable, is another question entirely. You know, we still haven't seen that demonstrated, and I don't think the Model 3 is going to help that case. But
if there's one thing that Apple differs from Tesla, is that they've never launched a low profit or no profit product. They've always been a eye watering profitable.
But to consumers, yeah, I mean, consumers don't think about that. Obviously, you know, they're not looking at what is the profit margin.
Sure, but it's a sustainability question,
right? They're looking at the user experience, and the user experience of, you know, what, assuming you don't get one that, you know, has some of the reliability problems that a lot of them have had. The user experience of driving a Tesla is amazing, you know, and it's very, I think in many ways it's very much on a par with the user experience of using an Apple product. And so from a consumer perspective, so far they've been willing to pay that premium, or at least somewhat of a premium.
You've test driven all of these, I suppose. And mm-hmm. So what's your feeling of the Tesla experience relative to i8 or something in I wouldn't say i3 necessarily, something in the same price range from
you know, for me personally, I'm conflicted because I love some I love a lot of aspects of the performance capabilities of the Model S. You know, the instant acceleration, that thrust, the low end torque that you get. But I mean, that's something that's characteristic of all electric vehicles. But I've always been an automotive enthusiast, and I also the visceral appeal of driving, you know, is something that attracts me. And I'm sure, you know, as someone who drives a 911, you know, I'm sure you understand this, Horace. You know,
it's a Cayman. It's not a 911.
You had a 911 before, right?
No, I never had a 911. Okay. I've driven one though.
Well, at any rate, even a Cayman, you know. There's something about the sound and the feel of driving, you know, for an enthusiast at least, that is, you know, is unique. And you know, there was an article that was somebody published, I think, on Quora some months ago, and then it got republished on Slate. You know, some a Tesla owner was complaining about, you know, why automotive enthusiasts hate Tesla.
Oh, they do.
And it, well, I don't. I wrote a rebuttal to that on Forbes. You know, and I don't think it's so much that automotive enthusiasts hate Tesla as such, but you know what Tesla offers to the enthusiast. You know, unless you're going to be drag racing it all the time, you know, the reality is you can't use, you know, 2-3 seconds 0-60 acceleration very often. And you know, it's a big 5,000-pound car, and it does remarkably well on the road for a big 5,000-pound car. But you know, it's not actually all that much fun to drive, other than that
thrust. The drag racing. I'll tell you who else
I'm
is.
I'm one of those people that, you know, prefers to drive a slow car fast than a fast car slow.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
So you know, I like the feeling of, you know, of, you know, feeling the road, hearing what's going on, and also the challenge. You know, I mean, I've driven a lot of, you know, very high performance cars, and it's fun. You know, there's a fun aspect to it, but you know, when you're driving, unless you're driving on the track all the time, if you're driving on real roads, you can't even come close to using the limits of that, you know, without putting yourself and others at great risk and being at risk of going to jail. Whereas, you know, in a Miata or a Scion FRS, you know, or Subaru BRZ, cars like that, you can push them, you can explore their limits, you know, at speeds that are much more reasonable in the real world, without, you know, going to jail. And, you know, it's not just a matter of the car, but it's also the whole experience of, you know, can you control this car? You know, what can you do with it? So to me, that's actually more appealing. So
we're drifting into a conversation for older males generally, I would say, at this point.
Yeah, well,
unfortunately,
that's who I am.
I know.
Hey, I resemble that remark. But
I mean, my 24-year-old daughter also really likes driving the Scion FRS. So.
Well,
and the Miata.
It's not always about the car. So, it's about the statement.
By the way, I've owned a Miata as well. I love that car. And I've also...
Except that speed, Horace. I mean, you when you hit 80 with that car, you're...
Who cares? It's like, this is the logic of you
better
know,
to
having
driven
a,
slowly.
Yeah, having an old English roadster or an Italian car, it's all the same. It's all about sensations.
Yeah.
So point taken. But
there's nothing logical about actually owning a car anyway. I mean, it's a totally irrational proposition for the most part. Yeah, I mean, if we were all logical when it came to cars, we'd all be driving, you know, minis.
Yeah.
You know?
Or not even minis. Something even
I do. I do want to. I do want to sort of close with our discussion on Horace brought up, you know, Apple's strategic use of their balance sheet. And we talked in a recent SimCar about Tesla and their big lofty goals to radically increase production in a shorter time frame than Henry Ford did it. And, you know, unfortunately, they don't have the balance sheet that Apple does. I mean, they have Wall Street to some extent. But, you know, I do wonder if you had that kind of cash to use strategically with suppliers, would that make a difference in the auto space, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly couldn't hurt. I mean, you know, I think assuming that, I mean, obviously Apple is working on cars, you know, whether or not they ever actually produce a car, build a car with an Apple badge on it is, you know, only time will tell about that. But, and I, I'm skeptical that they will. Assuming they want to maintain their margins, you know, then they'll probably never go down that path. But if they do, you know, they have those funds that they, you know, they could certainly finance their suppliers, you know, to ramp up.
Well, they, you know, they cornered
than Tesla could.
Yeah, I mean, if there are certain components, you know, they cornered the NAND memory supply during their iPod heyday, and you know, you just couldn't get any kind of volume, and so that's what I'm kind of getting at. You know, are there strategic suppliers or strategic assets that they, because of their balance sheet, can play in a different way than anybody else?
The where they might have the biggest advantage is on the battery side, you know, because most of the other components. You know, there's a number of suppliers that work with a lot of OEMs, and you know, I can't see them realistically cornering any markets on those. The one place where they could potentially do that is on batteries, especially if they can get some kind of breakthrough in terms of either, you know, improving the performance of the batteries or driving down the cost and ramping up that production fairly quickly. That would be the one potential place, you know, and I think obviously if Apple goes down the car path, you know, it will be an electric car, you know, and if they do it, you know, I think, you know, I sent you a link to a blog I wrote last fall, you know, where I think if Apple does decide to build cars, they won't actually try to sell them to consumers, but they will do it in certain specific markets as a mobility as a service type of model.
Yeah, I think,
well, that's the only way to play
the
margin game. I agree. Yeah.
Well, no, well, that dealing with, you know, dealing with the franchise dealer system,
right,
you know, that Tesla and still has a problem with.
Let's put it this way, and I think this is exactly the crux of the Apple entries, that some of it is manufacturing, some of it is innovation in process and so on, but experiences. But the thing is that if they really change it to a service rather than a product, then we're looking, then now you're cooking with gas, because the thing about the service model is that the economics of electric cars are so different because of the wear and tear and generally the maintenance equation, right? So if the car is very well built, And it's going to feel more like a truck in terms of its duty cycle, in terms of its ability to stay on the road for a certain time. Trucks have no problem going for a million miles, right? Trucks have, and buses are designed for a 24/7 operation. Taxis in Europe, for example, are often were, or maybe still are in some countries, Mercedes diesels, because they could run 24 hours a day and would last for millions of miles, and that was the logic of a vehicle that's a commercial use vehicle. And so when you, if you position the product because of its fundamentals, like as I said, a few moving parts, few stresses due to vibration, heat, and other forms of chemical, let's say the impact of chemistry that you have on the vehicle, that means it lasts longer. That means it's cheaper to maintain, and so that means that the economics of the product are such that here's a case in point. And I'm sort of not making my case well, but the point is that vehicles depreciate quickly. They tend to have finite lives because, even though they're not used as much, because that's the impact of the internal combustion as a component, is that it is corrosive to the vehicle in general. If that were to go away, then the product is no longer interesting as a something you upgrade every 3 years, because it lasts forever. It's like a Lada. You know, it's a great example, but you know, it's this kind of. And what is it that happened with Lada? Well, it started production in 70s and it kept going until the 2000s. You don't have to change it for 30 years. Same, you know, it's like those American cars in Cuba. They're still in use. There's like 1940s, 50s designs because they were good enough. And that logic of planned obsolescence that the industry is using in order for people to upgrade every 3 years is, it could all disappear. And so this is what gets me excited, because if you change the economics of the car to say it's a service, that also means that you, as the owner of that vehicle, which, you know, you're selling your service,
through the vehicle, then you want that vehicle to be timeless. Then you want that vehicle to last for 25 years rather than 10 years. Think a London taxi cab, right? The old ones, at least, that were just never changed. Mm-hmm. That's, to me, actually very exciting, because if we go away from the logic of disposable cars, the disposable car is a huge drain on the earth. It is a terrible thing. I've always maintained this. It's one reason I love Mercedes for so many years, was that they made cars to last, not made cars that were thought of as disposable. And it always bothered me that, why should we have cars last 10 years when we could make them easily last 25 years?
Yeah, well, and that, you know, that brings us back around to that original, you know, idea of the megacity cars, you know, and what, you know, my colleagues and I at Navigant foresee, you know, as being the future of urban transportation, is that the personally owned vehicle, you know, goes away as a concept, at least in urban areas, because, you know, first of all, you know, there's nowhere to park vehicles. There's nowhere to, you know, it's not practical for individual owners, you know, living in these mega cities, for the most part, to plug in and charge electric vehicles. So personal ownership, you know, makes less and less sense in those kinds of environments. You know, so mobility as a service, where you've got a number of providers that, you know, operate these fleets of autonomous vehicles that, you know, basically provide personal point-to-point mass transportation, you know, to take you wherever you need to go within a city, you know, when you need to go. And the vehicle's just there. When the battery runs down, it goes off to a central depot where it gets recharged. Or even in that kind of scenario, fuel cell vehicles start to make more sense, because, you know, within a limited if they're operating within a limited geographic area, you don't actually need very many fueling stations. You can refuel those in just a couple of minutes, and then they're back on their way and back into service. And instead of having vehicles that sit around idle 22 hours a day, you have vehicles that are utilized, you know, 70-80% of the time. You make more efficient use of the infrastructure you have within these cities, and while at the same time moving more people, more miles.
It's a very different margin game for somebody like Apple as well, from a service and capital. Everything's different.
And for every company that's involved in that space. And, I don't know if you saw the reports yesterday. There was a report yesterday in the Wall Street Journal that, you know, back in January, GM invested $500 million in Lyft. Yep. And at the time, they announced that they want to develop, you know, autonomous ride-hailing services. And they may be ready to start testing that as soon as 2017. Uber is working on the same sort of thing. They want to do the, you know, eliminate the driver from the equation. So there's a lot of benefits to that in terms of safety and efficiency. That's the direction, at least within urban areas, that, you know, that we'll see transportation moving, in combination with some mass transit, you know, for the most heavily trafficked corridors. You know, I mean, mass transit, you know, is great for moving large numbers of people, but it's limited by infrastructure, whether that be rails or whatever. You know, and then you have this mixed mode, this multimodal system with mass transit and autonomous on-demand vehicles to get you to the last mile.
Yeah.
Well, it's go ahead, Horace.
Sorry. Yeah. Just wrapping up.
Yes.
This is where really the conversation takes us over and over again, is that the real innovation is going to be not about the product, but the system, and real innovation is about the economics, the changing of ownership that may occur, and whether Apple can play in that direction is unclear. I mean, that they really are much more of the place where the brand shines as something you own. It's not something that you think of as a shared thing. But all of that can change. I'm never say never. So before we end, we just want to make sure that you. People know how to get a hold of you, and they can read your work. Can you tell us where they can find you?
Sure. Just Google my name, Sam Abualsamid, A-B-U-E-L-S-A-M-I-D, and you'll find all the places where you can find me. You'll find my blog at sam.abualsamid.com. You can find me on Forbes. You can find me at Navigant Research, where I publish various research reports, and we have a blog there that I write on as well. But yeah, just Google my name, and you'll find me everywhere.
Cool.
It's been a pleasure, Sam and Horace, and thanks for your time, and it was certainly very enlightening.
It was a pleasure to chat with you guys, and hope to do it again sometime soon.